Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we're opening up a pretty disturbing set of sources, detailing an incident that, well, it quickly blurred the lines between documented crime and, frankly, legend.
That happens sometimes with cases this unsettling.
Exactly. We're focusing on the events and the mythology surrounding a man named Elliot Crane, sometimes called the Man in the Field. His actions one summer basically turned a quiet part of rural Kentucky into this symbol of primal fear. There's an opening line from one of the reports that just, it cuts right to it. It says, "This man was the real-life Slytherin."
Wow. Yeah, that label Slytherin, it implies that cold, calculated kind of menace. And that's really key to the whole narrative we need to unpack today.
Right.
So our goal here in this deep dive is to look at the actual record, which is limited but really crucial, of what Elliot Crane did back in 1995. We want to trace those specific nights in the Kentucky foothills and then see how that fear just stuck around right up until his death in 2003.
And we have to be careful, right, with stories that generate this much public anxiety.
Absolutely vigilant. Details get exaggerated. Things like, you know, exactly how fast someone moves, specific quotes repeated years later, even these huge sentencing numbers. We have to recognize those might be part of the story, the lore that built up.
Okay.
So we'll anchor ourselves to the timeline, the structure of what actually happened, as best as the reports allow.
And this idea you mentioned, the calculated menace, it wasn't just random violence, was it? It was colder? That seems to set this case apart.
It really does. And there's an exchange, reportedly, from just before his sentencing that kind of highlights this methodical outlook. It apparently went something like this.
Someone asked him, "Elliot, are you dangerous right now?"
And his reply, "Danger doesn't turn off. It waits for a reason."
Chilling. It just suggests this. Patience. Waiting, not impulse, like you said, a reason.
Exactly. He wasn't just lashing out. So we're going to move chronologically through these reports, these excerpts. We'll look at the emotional journey the victims went through, from confusion to this sort of fearful resolve, and then, well, just sheer terror.
Okay, so let's start with the setting. Summer 1995, deep in the foothills of rural Kentucky. Why is that isolation so important here?
Well, it's everything, really. This isn't a crime happening under streetlights, you know, no close neighbors to hear anything or call for help easily. We're talking about a family home basically surrounded by fields, vast open fields.
Just the normal sounds of summer, cicadas maybe, crickets.
Exactly. The mundane rhythm of summer farming. That's the backdrop.
And it's into that setting that Crane introduces this specific kind of terror. It's such a sharp contrast, isn't it? That expected peace versus this creeping dread.
And the sources are clear. It wasn't instant panic. It built. It was a slow burn, deliberately established over three nights in a row.
Three nights. Okay, so what did they see?
The mechanism was observation. Night after night, the family saw the same figure, described as tall, thin, out in the field surrounding their house.
Standing there.
And the word that comes up again and again is motionless, completely still. He wasn't coming closer. He wasn't trying to hide or run away. Just standing among the crops, watching the house from a distance. Unsettling, but not immediately physically threatening.
Okay, I have to ask, why is stillness sometimes scarier than movement? If you've been running at the house, that's obviously terrifying, but it's a threat you can maybe understand. A burglar, of someone desperate.
Right, you can categorize it. But stillness. Stillness denies your brain the ability to predict intent. What's he waiting for? What's he planning? It turns the familiar, the safe, those fields they probably saw every single day, into something alien and threatening.
It becomes hostile territory.
Instantly. It's the beginning of what you might call a predator mythos, built on patience, observation, control. He controls the situation just by being there, watching.
So the reports suggest how the family's reaction changed over those three nights.
Yeah, it seems night one was maybe confusion, a bit of concern. Is it a prank? Someone lost. But night two, that's when the fear really amplified. The realization hits. This isn't random. He's watching us, specifically us, for hours.
Right.
Without doing anything. That creates that power dynamic you mentioned. They're just subjects under surveillance in their own home.
Exactly. And his choice to just watch, not act, elevates it. It becomes psychological warfare. The danger isn't physical yet, but the certainty that he's out there denying them the comfort and safety of their own space. That's immense pressure.
They can't ignore him, but confronting him feels incredibly risky, because they have no idea what he wants or what he'll do. Which brings us to the tipping point, night three. The documentation indicates a shift, that constant grinding fear. It started to change into something else. The sources use the word resolve. Resolve. Okay, what did that mean in practice?
It meant they decided they couldn't just be watched anymore. They had to engage. actively.
And this is where Uncle Larry comes in. Yes, Uncle Larry. Apparently, he'd had enough of the psychological siege. He decides he's going to confront the figure directly.
Okay.
And this act, this decision, it signals the end of the passive observation phase. So the moment they cross a threshold, maybe the most dangerous one, he grabs just a flashlight, nothing else.
A flashlight? Like he's trying to bring reason, illumination to it?
Symbolically, yes.
Yeah.
And he steps off the porch, across that boundary, into the darkness towards the figure.
And that's the trigger.
That's the immediate trigger for everything that follows. Think about the psychology here.
Mm.
As long as they stayed inside, safe in the known, the figure stayed motionless, a static threat. The second Larry steps out, moves towards him. He gives Crane the reason, his earlier quote mentioned, the reason danger was waiting for
him. The game changed instantly. The micro takeaway here is stark. The line between that psychological watching and sudden physical violence wasn't blurry. It wasn't a gradual escalation. It was a switch flipped, catastrophic. That one decision,
yeah.
Stepping off the porch. Wow.
Yeah. So Larry steps out. Maybe he expected the figure to run, or maybe to talk, who knows. But that's not what happened.
What did happen?
The narrative just snaps. Witnesses describe it as velocity shock. The figure that had been utterly motionless for 3 nights explodes into movement. Rapid, overwhelming threat.
And the reports use specific language for this speed.
Consistently. Unnaturally fast. That phrase is critical. Now, whether it literally defied physics or just seemed impossibly fast after hours of total stillness.
The perception was the same.
It traumatized them. It immediately established Crane as something other, operating outside normal human limits. It created this instant feeling of absolute powerlessness.
How long did the actual confrontation last?
Seconds, according to the documents, just seconds. Larry, with his flashlight, that symbol of trying to bring reason to it, he was taken down almost instantly.
And a flashlight?
Dropped, spinning in the dirt. That becomes this really tragic, potent image. The light source is plunging everything into chaos and darkness, symbolizing that lost control, that shattered attempt at resolve, extinguished immediately.
God, that image. A spinning flashlight in the dark.
It's powerful. And the attack wasn't random. It was directional, focused. Larry wasn't just attacked. He was immediately dragged towards a specific place.
Where?
An old storage shed at the edge of the property.
The shed. Okay, so that implies he knew it was there. Maybe yeah. Planned to use it.
It certainly suggests a premeditated destination. Suddenly, this ordinary farm shed becomes this highly charged location, a potential site of, well, implied trauma. It's no longer just a shed.
And the family back at the house, they see this happening.
They witness it from the porch or the windows, and their reaction is pure panic, desperation. They don't hesitate. They don't wait for police.
They go after him.
They run out of the house. And they grab whatever they can find as weapons. The sources actually list them.
Yeah.
Axes, shovels.
Makes sense. Farm tools.
And a plunger.
A plunger. Seriously.
Seriously. And that detail, the plunger, it just underscores the chaos, right? Mm-hmm. The total abandonment of any kind of plan. It's sheer primal defense mode. No time for rational thought. Just grab anything.
Wow. So they chase Crane and Larry towards this shed?
Yes. They pursue him right to the shed door. And this door becomes the next critical threshold in the story, arguably the most traumatic one.
What happens at the door?
They reach it, fueled by adrenaline, ready to fight to rescue Larry. They fling the door open and then just stop. Dead in their tracks. Yeah. Momentum, the pursuit, it all just grinds to an immediate halt.
They see something inside.
It's the moment the narrative just hits a wall.
Yeah.
Observation gives way to witnessing something apparently unspeakable.
They fling the door open and then immediately freeze where they stand. Pause and box. 6 seconds.
Okay. So that moment of paralysis.
Yeah.
It's followed by an immediate decisive action. And what they do next speaks volumes about the nature of whatever horror they saw in there.
What did they do? Did they try to help Larry?
No. There was no cry to rescue him. Not in that instant. The impulse was immediate, primal. And it was about containment.
Mm-hmm.
Self-preservation, maybe, but also societal safety.
Containment?
Slammed the door shut immediately. And locked it from the outside.
Locked him in with Larry.
Locked it in. Whatever it was they saw. The shed lock, the hasp, that becomes this powerful new symbol. It wasn't about rescue right then. It was about securing whatever unspeakable thing they'd just glimpsed.
And then they ran for help.
Then they ran back to the house to call the police.
That choice to lock the door first before trying to save family.
It overrides the most basic human instinct, doesn't it? to protect your own. Whatever they saw inside that shed must have felt so fundamentally wrong, so far outside the bounds of expected violence, that containing the threat became the absolute first priority. It tells you everything about the psychological impact.
Yeah, that's the moment it becomes more than just a crime, it becomes a legend.
Right. So the police arrive? Must have been a scene of just utter chaos, hysteria. Eventually, the man inside the shed is restrained.
And the scene itself, did it offer clues? Besides the shed.
Well, the reports mention more than just the flashlight. They talk about specific rows of crops near the shed being flattened, trampled down. Physical evidence of that sudden violent movement, the struggle, maybe corroborating that sense of unnatural speed.
Okay, so they restrain him and they identify him.
Yes. With his restraint, the figure gets a name, an identity. He's identified as Elliot Crane. This is the official point where he shifts from being this folklore figure in the fields to a documented criminal suspect.
But the documentation immediately confirms the severity of it all. What about Larry?
Larry's condition.
Yeah.
It grounds the whole terrifying event in brutal medical reality. His injuries were so severe, he had to be placed in an induced coma.
An induced coma? For how long?
This is astonishing. The sources specify the duration needed for his recovery. Approximately 2 years.
2 years in a coma.
2 years. It's just a harrowing indicator of the sheer physical violence of that attack. So even though parts of the encounter felt unnatural or psychologically overwhelming to the witnesses, the outcome was devastatingly physical and real.
Did he? Did Larry eventually recover?
The story does include that detail, thankfully. He did eventually wake up and reportedly made a full recovery.
Okay.
That timeline, 2 years, it just underscores the profound trauma, physical and mental.
And while Larry's fighting for his life in a coma, what about Elliot Crane? His persona starts to form immediately, right?
Instantly. In the eyes of the public, the media, his behavior during questioning just poured fuel on the fire. While he was being held, apparently, Elliot remained almost completely silent. Defiantly silent, some reports suggest.
Which just reinforced that image of him being cold, calculating,
a Slytherin thing
again.
Exactly. His silence created a vacuum. And the media, the public, they rushed to fill it with their worst fears. Since he offered no motive, no explanation, no remorse, people projected onto him. That's likely where quotes started surfacing. Like the one widely reported, Elliot Crane is the most evil man I have ever encountered. His silence was almost a weapon in itself.
It functioned that way, whether he intended it or not. It allowed him to become this sort of blank screen onto which everyone projected horror.
And it seems the only times he did speak were in these short, calculated ways that just cemented that image, like that quote about danger waiting for a reason.
Right. That mindset, reportedly coming out just before sentencing, is key. It suggests he wasn't driven by blind rage. He operated on opportunity. He waited. He calculated.
And that waiting, that calculation, that's precisely why the family found him so terrifying in the first place. He was a thinking, planning source of violence. If you connect it back to those 3 nights of stillness, his behavior makes perfect, horrifying sense. He wasn't stuck or unsure out there in the fields. He was waiting. Establishing the conditions, maybe. Waiting for the optimal moment.
And the moment Larry crossed the threshold.
The waiting was over. The reason had arrived. The mechanism engaged.
So the case moves to the courts. And the legend just keeps growing.
It totally consumed the legal disposition. When we talk about his sentencing, we really have to be careful. Treat the reported numbers as, well, judicial folklore almost.
Mm.
Part of the legend, not necessarily verifiable, fact-checked court records.
Okay, so what's the number that became legendary? The one everyone remembers?
The story that got locked into public memory, the number that achieved instant infamy, was that Elliot Crane was sentenced to 500 consecutive life terms.
500 consecutive. That sounds impossible.
It sounds impossible, right?
Mm?
And whether it's literally accurate or not, think about what a sentence like that does narratively. A normal, severe sentence, you know, 50 years to life, maybe multiple life sentences served concurrently, that addresses the legal crime.
But 500 consecutive.
That signifies maximum cultural rejection, total condemnation. It's society saying, through the lens of the justice system or the media reporting on it, we want this person gone so completely that even if they lived for centuries, they'd never get out.
Yeah.
It's a symbol of absolute hyperbolic horror, reflecting the psychological impact. Not just the legal facts.
It's like they needed a punishment as unnatural as the crime felt.
Precisely. The punishment needed to feel legendary to match the legendary fear he inspired. And that notoriety, it didn't end when the prison doors shut.
He became infamous inside prison, too.
Absolutely. Life behind bars just gave the mythos a new stage. He apparently became this figure of dread, even among corrections staff, people who deal with violent offenders every single day.
So the prison environment, which is all about control, couldn't contain the feeling he gave off.
It seems not. The anecdotes we have from guards or local sources really reinforce this. They paint a picture of this institutional mythology building up around him inside.
Is there a specific quote that captures that?
Yeah, there's one that's particularly telling. A guard or someone local is quoted as saying something like, "Boy, oh boy, Elliot sure knows his way around here. He's different. You can feel him before you even see him. Gives me chills, baby. You can feel him before you even see him." Wow, that connects right back to the fields, doesn't it?
Directly. The fear wasn't just about what he might do in prison. We don't have many details on that. It was about what he was, this chilling presence that arrived before he did, that sense of being watched, even when you couldn't see the watcher.
The predator mythos just adapted to the new environment.
It seems so. The prison, this controlled space, became a test. Could his danger be contained? And the fact that staff still described him as different, as unnerving, it suggests he maintained that cold, calculating exterior. He never integrated, maybe never showed vulnerability. That's why they feared him. So, despite the crazy sentence, the legend, the actual record does have an endpoint.
It does. Both the legend and the record come to a finite, documented conclusion. In 2003, that's 8 years after the summer night that put him into true crime lore, Elliot Crane's life ended.
Wow.
The sources stated pretty plainly, with the finality you get from official records. In 2003, Elliot was found unresponsive after some kind of incident in the prison showers. He did not survive.
So the end comes, not in the open fields, but in the most controlled environment possible, a prison shower.
There's a powerful irony there, isn't there? His crime involved that unnatural speed, sudden violence, the psychological terror of the open, uncontained rural space. Yet his life ends in this completely enclosed, monitored institutional setting.
The documentation ends with control.
The documentation ends there. But the legend, the story of the man in the field, the Slytherin who waited for his reason, that persists. Because the facts were just so quickly amplified by the sheer psychological trauma they caused. #outro. So when we pull back and look at the whole arc of the Elliot Crane case, what we really see is a study in contrasts. You have the terrifying power, that absolute stillness, right before the explosion of destructive, seemingly unnatural speed.
And you see how one single act, Uncle Larry deciding to cross that porch threshold, triggered immediate, devastating consequences.
And fundamentally, I think we see how that specific context, the deep rural isolation, really acted as an amplifier. It took a horrific, factual crime and helped turn it into this persistent, deeply unsettling American legend. It allowed the fear to fester and grow in a way it might not have elsewhere.
Yeah. And to really process a story like this, you kind of need those physical anchors, right? The objects that represent the psychological weight of it all.
Definitely.
We have those symbols of failure or maybe lost hope, like the spinning flashlight in the dirt. That moment, rational control was just snuffed out.
And then there's the defining choice afterwards. That heavy, locked hasp on the shed door, slamming it shut, locking away the terror they'd just witnessed. Containment over rescue. Powerful symbols. And then there's the immediate, transient evidence left behind by the event itself, the physical disruption caused by that violent transformation out there in the field.
Right. What remains is just the undeniable evidence of that moment, the chilling mark he left before the silence fell again.
The flattened cornrow bears witness to the speed of the strike.